Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1996, when the Taliban first took control of Afghanistan, they banned music and independent journalism and television. The only radio station was the state-owned Taliban Voice of Sharia. It mostly broadcast calls to prayer and religious chants. In late 2001, after the fall of the Taliban, Saad Mohseni launched the Mobi Group. He bought a radio license. And in April 2003, Arman FM went on the air. The station played music from Afghanistan and from around the world, and men and women bantered with each other on the air as well. In 2004, Mohseni launched Tolo TV, which broadcasts entertainment television, soap operas, and a reality singing competition called Afghan Star. And in 2010, he launched Tolo News, Afghanistan's first 24/7 news channel. In short, Saad Mohseni is one of Afghanistan's most influential media entrepreneurs, who also helped establish a free and independent press in Afghanistan. So, of course, the question now is, how long will it stay that way? And Saad Mohseni joins us now from London. He's chairman and chief executive of Mobi Group. Mr. Mohseni, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well. But, of course, the question is, how are you and how is Afghanistan and particularly the state of that free and independent media there. So let me just get a sense about, give our listeners a sense of your story. First of all, tell us about that 2001 time period for you. Where were you before the fall of the Taliban, and what did you decide to do thereafter?
I was actually, when 9/11 happened, I was in Australia. And I watched, actually, the second plane hit the World Trade Center. And I thought to myself that this is somehow connected to Afghanistan. I mean, we were just so obviously always monitoring what was transpiring in Afghanistan. And at the time, it was obvious that a lot of terrorist organizations were active. And I thought if this is an act of terrorism, then obviously Afghanistan is somehow involved. And then within days, obviously, it became obvious that the Americans would do something about Afghanistan. And then we had the opportunity to travel to the country in 2002. And that's when we thought we should look at some business opportunities, and media was one of them. And we established, as you mentioned before, the first independent media outlet. And it was, even in those days, it was so controversial that it sort of sucked us all in, and it sort of became our full-time endeavor. And
Sorry, just jump in here for a second. I'd love to tell me more about why, even in those days after the fall of the Taliban, it was still controversial for on Arman FM, as I mentioned, men and women to be talking with each other on the radio. Why was it still controversial then?
Well, you have to remember that the communist regime, or the regime that was supported by the Soviets, fell in 1992. So for 3 years, for the first 3 years, you had the Mujahideen government, and they were fairly conservative, and there wasn't much music. And then the Taliban came, and there was no music, and there was no television. So you had almost 9 years of maybe almost 10 years of no entertainment, and this sort of the generation that was in Kabul at the time hadn't been exposed to media for such a long time that there was this, I wouldn't call it a backlash, but I think it was more a shock that why do we have a man and a woman in a studio? Why are they joking? Or why do we have this sort of this pop music on the airwaves? So, you know, and a lot of people The Islamists, who were allies of the U.S., obviously prominent members of the coalition that was now running Afghanistan, they didn't like what they were listening to. So we had no security or anything. We just operated out of this residential dwelling. And all of a sudden, you know, we had people literally knocking on the door of the compound, asking us who we were. And it was actually for a few days, it was quite scary.
Ah, did you have the support of the United States, though? Because one would imagine that the development of a healthy media and then, you know, independent journalism ecosystem there would have been key, or is key, to the development of Afghanistan.
Well, I think in principle we did, but how these things work. I mean, it's not like everything's planned and coordinated. We started, as a matter of fact, it was actually a test signal. We just needed to test if the signal was strong enough, if the DJs were competent. For most of them, they've never experienced anything like we were doing. So just for them to have this casual banter was a big step. We didn't expect a reaction, but I think people caught on really quickly. Like within hours, I think the entire city was listening to the radio station, and I was overseas at the time. I had to scramble back to Kabul just to see if we could get some sort of control over the public reaction. It's quick. I mean, it's amazing how quickly also people adapted. Within weeks, it was like the most normal thing you could do.
That's quite a change, isn't it?
Well, we sometimes we talk about facilitating social change, and I think that all it takes is just to expose people to something new, and people adapt very quickly. It's that exposure that's important, and to have the courage to expose people to something new, something that they're not familiar with.
Mm. Well, so then tell me, it was about a year later, 2004, as I mentioned, that you launched Tolo TV. Did you presume, or maybe an entrepreneur would presume anything is not a wise question. Let me rephrase that. What were your hopes upon the launching of Tolo Television TV? Did you dare to hope that it would be as successful as Arman Radio was and as fast?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we felt, okay, well, let's give this a try. People did warn us. They said, whatever you experienced with radio, television is the same, plus its own steroids. I mean, the impact is so much more powerful in terms of how you're going to impact the viewers, but also how people would react to your outlet and to your programming. So, but, we were better prepared, I think, in terms of managing people's expectations and particular people in the in government and the establishment, let's call them that, members of the opposition, politicians, religious leaders, and so forth. It wasn't easy. As a matter of fact, what we were experiencing now today with the Taliban sort of takes me back to what we were experiencing in 2003 and 2004 and onwards.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, for example, I mean, you know, our music shows were very controversial. There would be indictments every single day for something we were doing, whether it was a soap opera or a music show or something. And it was just managing this reaction. I mean, getting an indictment in Afghanistan is a real pain because it could, a bit like India and other parts of our neighborhood. The legal process is a pretty complicated, long-winded one. So once you get an indictment, you could get summoned daily before the prosecutor. Then the case goes to the courts. It's just a real pain, and we had to put up with all of that. And plus, also, we were controversial because also the way we covered news was new. We tackled things head-on. As a matter of fact, we were the first ones to inform on in terms of civilian casualties from U.S. and Afghan operations, especially airstrikes. And there was a period we were really scared that the Americans would target us because they were, you know, they were really unhappy with our coverage. We went to, you know, the south or the east or even just areas surrounding Kabul and interviewed victims and challenged the state, challenged the Afghan government and the Americans as to why, you know, they were continuing to target civilians when they were, you know, mounting these operations. So we had, I think initially not many people liked us, and we were always concerned that we would get shut down by the state or attacked by the Americans, especially after what happened to Al Jazeera and in Baghdad. It was a constant fear that we had. And of course, we, you know, learned to manage, you know, find people we could talk to in government, find people we could talk to in the American military and the coalition forces and so forth. It just, we learned to manage everyone, which, you know, we didn't know much about in the earlier years.
So we've just about a minute and a half before our first break. Tell me a little bit more about what kind of successes you felt that particularly Tolo News had, because I keep thinking about how essentially you were creating a media ecosystem from nothing, right? Because the Taliban had so thoroughly shut down almost all media before that. So there was a ton of room to introduce the Afghan people to all sorts of, like every possible imaginable story. So what were one or two of the other successes you had?
Well, I mean, we just wanted to win the trust of the Afghan public. So it was very important for us in terms of our news reporting that we spoke truth to power, that we challenged everyone. We attempted to even give the Taliban a voice in the early years. And understand why people were beginning to take up arms against the government and the state and the coalition forces. That to us was really important. We also started to notice that, you know, that the state was becoming corrupt, and in addition to being inept, that to us was also important. The key thing was that, you know, if everyone's unhappy, then we're doing a good job.
Yeah. Well, Saad Mohseni joins us today. He is the chairman and chief executive of Mobi Group, an independent media company in Afghanistan. He's in London, and we're talking about the future of Afghanistan's free and independent press. We'll have much more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today it's our final episode of our series this week called The Longest War, where we've been looking at the impact of 20 years of the United States military involvement in Afghanistan. And today we're actually also looking ahead with Saad Mohseni. He is the chairman and chief executive of Mobi Group, an independent media company founded in Afghanistan, hugely influential in terms of creating a free and independent press in Afghanistan. So, Mr. Mohseni, I wonder if you could tell me about how your journalists are doing now in Afghanistan. What are the conditions they're working with? Have they been able to continue their work?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, we have no safety nets. Whereas previously we had people, allies in government, we had the opposition figures who some were very supportive of the media, civil society, members of parliament. And even within the judiciary, we knew that some judges were pretty fair. And then, of course, last but not least, the international community and its presence in Afghanistan sort of gave us a degree of hope that if push came to shove, that they would come out and support us. Right now, there is no safety net. You can complain to the Taliban, but you know it's far from certain if they would help. Although you know we have a good relationship with the spokesperson's office. Other than that, we really know no one. I don't think anyone knows the interior minister, the man in charge, Sarajuddin Haqqani, or anyone's met him. So for us, it's the daily challenges of covering news is very daunting. We've had reporters beaten up, arrested. We had one arrested 2-3 days ago. Luckily, he was released after a couple of hours. But two other reporters were badly beaten, as you may have read. Mm-hmm. So just going out to do a story is daunting. We let the local managers decide as to what they do on a daily basis, but it's a day by day decision making. They decide on a particular day if they're going to send people out, if they can cover a story or not, how they would cover it. It's not easy.
Tolu News has female journalists as well. Are they still able to do their work?
Yes, yes. I mean, I'm not sure how much you know, but we lost perhaps up to 100 individuals who took advantage of this opportunity to leave the country with the various evacuation plans put in place by the international community. So we had this sort of this twin challenge of not only ensuring that the people who wanted to leave could leave and getting them into the airport securely, but we also had to keep the organization going. And we had to hire people. I mean, there were days we didn't know that if we could carry on because we didn't have the right technical people and we didn't have the right presenters. But since then, we've managed to hire other female journalists, which is extraordinary. So it seems that there's a bench deep enough for us to continue to be able to hire. But for us, it's very important to have female journalists. To have people like God and interview people, to have people inside the studio, present programs, and we will persist for as long as possible.
How long do you think that might be?
I'm not sure. It could be a week. It could be a year. It could be an hour. This lack of, we have no visibility in terms of what's going to transpire next. So we have this cabinet where they have a minister for information and culture, and they have a new government. We're not sure what media laws they're drafting. We don't know what directives they'll issue in relation to the media, in relation to women's rights, in relation to women presenting on television. So we don't know.
You know, it was, well, you definitely know, but it was what, 2 or 3 weeks ago, middle of August, right, where the Taliban insisted that they were going to continue to respect freedom of expression in Afghanistan. Do you believe that?
Well, I think they see that. I mean, there are individuals within the Taliban who are obviously more pragmatic and more moderate than others. And I think they do also understand that media has played a very positive role in Afghanistan in terms of, challenging the authorities, exposing corruption. And as I mentioned before, speaking truth to power. And they probably, aspects of what the media does, they appreciate. But the question is, what does free media mean to the Taliban? Can you challenge the state? Which is, the leader of the faithful, Haibatullah, I mean, he cannot be challenged, technically speaking. Can we challenge his government? Can we challenge different officials in the Islamic Emirate, for example? We don't know. We don't know. I mean, these are things we'll find out. But the one thing we're doing right now, as we have done in the past, is that we are challenging them daily, whether it's in relation to women's rights or the fighting inside the country. In terms of what freedom of expression means, every single day there's a news story. Every single day there are debates on television, and the Taliban are forced to come out and actually say things like, "We will support women's rights," or "We will support freedom of expression." As to what they do next, I'm not too sure. But the fact that they're being forced or challenged to comment on these issues and to come on television and explain means that, you know, we're perhaps doing something right.
So, Mr. Mohseini, please feel fully free to correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't want to fall into the trap of oversimplification. But the most noble purpose of a free and independent press, which, you know, your reporters in Afghanistan are still continuing to try to pursue, is, as you said, to speak truth to power, to challenge received narratives from those in government, to essentially provide different and new ways of thinking by uncovering stories. All of those goals seem to me to be completely in opposition to the mindset of a fundamentalist group, which I will call the Taliban. The Taliban self-identifies as fundamentalist, does it not? So I just don't understand. Again, if this is too simplistic of a reading, please tell me. But I do not understand how those two can coexist for a long period of time.
You're right. You're right. But we have to. We can't give up. I mean, the difference, I think a lot of people ask the same question. We also have an obligation as Afghans and as a media organization to fight this fight for as long as we can, even if the impact is 1%. For us to continue to engage with the Taliban, to challenge, is worth it. I mean, the day we can't, then obviously we will just shut our doors and just leave the place and continue our work perhaps from outside. But for now, we can do this, and we're on the airwaves and people are watching, in particular the news networks. I mean, our viewership just for the political shows is up 86%. So Afghans are watching, you know, these programs around the clock. So whether it has an impact on the Taliban, I'm not too sure, but it certainly has an impact on the Afghan population.
So that's really important to understand. Tell us more about that, because we've been hearing across this week lots of people telling us that, you know, 2021 is different than the late 90s insofar as, because of technology and because of expectation now, that, you know, perhaps the clock cannot be turned back. To a sort of a pre-media literate Afghanistan when the Taliban were first in power?
You know, people ask me, and, you know, has the last two decades been a waste of money and time? And I say no. I mean, I put it to these Europeans a few days ago. What if we have succeeded in Afghanistan? But because we've changed a generation of Afghans. Afghanistan has the youngest population outside of sub-Saharan Africa, median age of 18, something like 60-65% of the population is under the age of 22 or 23. If you look at the younger generation of Afghans, the under 30s, the vast majority are illiterate. And we're talking about 70-75% of the population. These people have totally different expectations. They see things completely differently. They're aspirational. They have ambitions. They're technology savvy. They have an open mind in relation to everything. I mean, the one thing that we're sort of proud of is that the fact that we have not, unlike the media in the US, for example, you know, we believe that people should be intellectually humble and they should look at different points of view and they should be exposed to different points of view. And Afghans, I think, to a large extent, have an open mind, and especially the younger generation of urbanite Afghans. So I think for these people, it's going to be very difficult to go back to 2000 or 2001, when the Taliban last ruled over the country. Even for the Taliban fighters, they've been exposed to technology, they've been exposed to social media. They may perhaps consume a different form of content, but they still use the same means to get that content. So even for them, this, you know, complete shutdown of the country, which is always a possibility, is going to be unacceptable. So I think it's, you know, women coming out and protesting against the Taliban don't even know how to deal with that. And I think that that'll only get, I mean, that will deteriorate for the Taliban, because I think the country, is, which is already one of the poorest countries in the world, if this economic crisis continues, I think people are going to come out and protest and challenge the their authority. And I think, and this is why they're so fearful of the media, and they're attempting to engage the media and even threaten us. So we don't cover these types of stories, but we will for as long as we can.
Well, I've just got a minute and a half left with you and two more quick questions here. First of all, what do you think Americans most need to understand about what's happening in Afghanistan now that we don't understand properly?
That it's a changed country, that don't forget Afghanistan, the vast majority are moderate. The Taliban's approval rating was never more than 10 or 15%. Afghans were stuck between a dictatorial, hardcore fundamentalist movement such as the Taliban and an inept, corrupt government in the Ashraf Ghani government. But the vast majority of Afghans are no different to any other nationality in terms of what their needs are and what their wants are. So don't forget Afghans. Your war may have ended, but for us, it could be the beginning of something much more sinister and much more nasty.
And your hope for Afghanistan in the last few seconds that we have?
That we persist. We're a resilient bunch, but, you know, it gets tiring to be resilient. Mm-hmm.
Well, Saad Mohseni is the chairman and chief executive of Mobi Group, an independent media company in Afghanistan, really one of the key people to help establish Afghanistan's free and independent press there, and hopefully one that can remain as such for as long as possible. Mr. Mohseni, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, you heard Saad Mohseni talk about the young people of Afghanistan and how, by dint of numbers and their personal experience, how influential they will be in the country's future. So we spoke with some young expat Afghans with deep connections to their home still, and we heard what they want for their country's future.
My name is Aisha Barakse. I'm 19 years old and I'm from Afghanistan. And I was around 12 years old when I went to Pakistan, and I was around 14 when I came to US.
My name is Dr. Iman Ahmed Sadiq, and I am 33 years old. I'm an Afghan refugee myself. My parents left in the 80s during the Soviet invasion.
My name is Sana Safi. I am 32 years old. I was born in Afghanistan in 1989. I was 7 years old when I went to school, and I was told that the Taliban say girls can't come in.
My thoughts on what's happening in Afghanistan is summarized in one word: heartbroken.
It's really heartbreaking.
I'm exhausted. And the reason is that I haven't had the time to process what has been happening.
It was my mother who was on the front lines, arrested in protests in the 80s against the communist invasion. And now I see women lining the streets of Kabul, Herat, protesting the same way. And yet, the situation that they will face, what they will endure, I fear, is far more horrific and gruesome.
At times, I get the flashbacks. Flashbacks of, I was seven. I didn't go to school. I wasn't allowed to go to school. And then this realization that, is this going to be the same for the young girls who are growing up now, for the seven-year-olds right now? Are they going to be stopped from going to schools? Will the international community completely isolate them, isolate the country, cut off relationship with the regime? Will the women be able to ever go back to work the way they used to in the last 20 years? So it's lots of questions, and still, I think, mentally, it's still very dizzying.
The young people who are there have only known a life filled with strife and war and suffering. And every time they gain hope, it's been stripped away.
I'm hoping for the future of Afghanistan to change. Otherwise, all Afghan women and children will not have any future left.
For Afghanistan, I want them to be self-sufficient. I want them to have the food, the shelter, the safety to live in and enjoy their lives.
My hope for the future of Afghanistan feels somewhat like a fairy tale. The fairy tale that was told to me as a bedtime story of the beautiful mountains, the beautiful fields, the huge, huge fields of grapes, the delicious fruits, the hustle and bustle of the streets, the kindness and generosity of the people.
People would be walking down the street without being scared.
A country that they want for themselves, a country that they're comfortable in, a country that can provide them safety, security, and that they're happy in.
The world will be shocked by how brave Afghan people were and how brave Afghans are.
It is a dream of a place where the people can live the true meaning of the word salam. Salam meaning peace, everlasting peace.
Dr. Iman Ahmad Sadiq, Aisha Barekzai, and Sana Safi on their hopes for Afghanistan's future. When we come back, Jack Beatty joins us with his view on the continuing impact of the longest war on all Americans. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The war in Afghanistan lasted 20 years and across four presidencies, beginning with President George W. Bush in 2001.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
2002, President Bush in his State of the Union address.
The last time we met in this chamber, the mothers and daughters of Afghanistan were captives in their own homes, forbidden from working or going to school. Today, women are free and are part of Afghanistan's new government. And we welcome the new Minister of Women's Affairs, Dr. Seema Sumar.
2009, President Obama and the surge.
Afghanistan is not lost, but for several years it has moved backwards. There's no imminent threat of the government being overthrown, but the Taliban has gained momentum. Al-Qaeda has not reemerged in Afghanistan in the same numbers as before 9/11, but they retain their safe havens along the border. And our forces lack the full support they need to effectively train and partner with Afghan security forces and better secure the population.
2015, President Obama.
I've decided to maintain our current posture of 9,800 troops in Afghanistan through most of next year, 2016. But maintaining our current posture through most of next year, rather than a more rapid drawdown, will allow us to sustain our efforts to train and assist Afghan forces as they grow stronger.
2017, President Trump.
We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military activities. Conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables, will guide our strategy from now on. America's enemies must never know our plans or believe they can wait us out. I will not say when we are going to attack.
2020, President Trump and the withdrawal agreement.
We've had tremendous success in Afghanistan in the killing of terrorists, but it's time to bring our people back home. We want to bring our people back home. I really believe the Taliban wants to do something to show that we're not all wasting time. If bad things happen, we'll go back.
My fellow Americans, the war in Afghanistan is now over.
2021, President Biden.
It was time to be honest with the American people again. We no longer had a clear purpose in an open-ended mission in Afghanistan. After 20 years of war in Afghanistan, I refuse to send another generation of America's sons and daughters to fight a war that should have ended long ago.
Four presidents and their responsibility for the longest war. The Afghanistan war is especially powerful for us here at On Point. This program got its start 20 years ago, on September 17th, 2001. And Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, has been with the show every day from the beginning, and he's here with us now. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Jack, just your first thoughts on this 20-year continuum and now end to the Afghanistan war as we've been marking it across this week.
Well, I'm proud, frankly, of our program and the way we have stood in relation to this 20-year war. Right from the start, led by our host, Tom Ashbrook, we looked at the claims of successive administrations with the most jaundiced eye. And this began right from the start. We had heard that the Project for a New American Century, which was a right-wing group that had been pressuring Bill Clinton to make war on Iraq, we had heard that they were preparing some sort of statement to send to the Bush administration, which was peopled with their alumni. So I called a friend at the Weekly Standard. It was led by this group, by Bill Kristol, the editor, and asked him, did he know anything about it? And he said, well, yes. In fact, he had the letter there, and they had sent it out that day, and he faxed the letter. And I read the letter on the air that night, and the letter said that leaving Saddam Hussein in power would be a, quote, early and perhaps decisive surrender in the war on international terrorism. And the letter said this didn't matter whether Saddam had anything to do with 9/11 or not. And, of course, as we know from our interview, subsequently we ran some of it yesterday with Kofor Black, the CIA operative, the administration was talking about extending this war almost from the first day to Iraq. And so here were these neoconservatives saying you've got to attack Iraq early. And we said on the air that this was, in fact, an insanity. And to underline how dire and desperate a proposal this was, we quoted the British military historian Sir Michael Howard writing that weekend in The Observer. He said, an attack on Iraq in the context of an inflamed Islamism around the world would be tantamount to a nuclear exchange in the Cold War. Well, on the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis it killed, it was a nuclear war, and the Americans as well. And as Peter Bergen and others have pointed out, it was a recruiting day for al-Qaeda all over the world.
And here we are, Jack, in 2021. Terrorism, it's a chimeric thing. It's taken on a new, even more urgent form here inside the United States, has it not?
It has indeed. And, you know, you could say that January 6th, the attack on the Capitol, that completed the mission the terrorists were embarked on Flight 93. Flight 93, the United Airlines flight that crashed thanks to the heroic efforts of the passengers in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, that the target, they thought, of that plane was the Capitol. Well, the domestic terrorists completed the mission. on January 6th.
Mm. Well, I want to, again, go back in the On Point time machine here. And this is from September 25th, 2001. You and then-host Tom Ashbrook spoke with Robert E. Hunter, former U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Clinton, who said this.
As important as stopping terrorism is, it isn't taking on a Soviet Union with tentacles and troops all over the world and with a huge army poised potentially to invade Western Europe. You have a relatively small number of these terrorists, but they're operating in a much broader sea.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to NATO Robert E. Hunter on this program, September 25th, 2001. How does that fall on your ears now, Jack?
Well, yeah, he's making it seem like not the existential struggle that we made it into. And in fact, at the time, there was reporting in The New Yorker from defense experts saying what's needed here against bin Laden is fine work, bribes, bounties, on-the-ground intelligence, finding out where these people are, not invading Afghanistan. And also on that interview, Robert Hunter made a very important point. Bush was saying, why do they attack us? They hate our freedom. Why do they attack us, Ambassador Hunter? He was in the first Bush administration at the time, State Department. He said, well, the casus belli was that we stationed troops in Saudi Arabia. And that was the reason bin Laden attacked us, because the presence of Americans and, my God, women are among our troops, defiled the Arabian Peninsula.
Jack, I want to go back to where you started with the very quick pivot that the Bush administration made to Iraq. And there is a particular moment in the run-up to the Iraq War that we both remember, and that is then Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations Security Council, really justifying the U.S.'s desire to prosecute a war in Iraq, the claim that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And here's a moment from Powell's speech to the Security Council.
We know from sources that a missile brigade outside Baghdad was dispersing rocket launchers and warheads containing biological warfare agent. Most of the launchers and warheads had been hidden in large groves of palm trees and were to be moved every 1 to 4 weeks to escape detection. We also have satellite photos that indicate that banned materials have recently been moved from a number of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction facilities.
Jack, what do you think is particularly important to understand about that moment now, as we're actually looking back at 20 years of the Afghanistan war?
The media coverage. That night, the network news devoted almost all of its time to that speech. And Powell was a unique bearer of prestige. We all knew that he had good things in mind. He wasn't a hawk and so on. And later on, he's been quoted as saying that he was, in fact, a patsy for the hawk in that speech. When the problems with the speech became evident, Tom Brokaw said, well, it was our responsibility on NBC to report what he had to say. And frankly, he said, I had nothing that I could point to that was contrary to what Powell testified to. Well, he may not have had anything, but Tom Ashbrook and I and our producers had things. We had what the inspectors had said about the particular sites that Powell cited. And of course, some of the claims were too ludicrous to refute, so we just call them ludicrous. For example, the idea that Saddam could put chemical weapons on a barge and send it through the Mediterranean, the Straits of Gibraltar, across the Atlantic, and then into New York Harbor, that any grown person could say something like that. But of course, the press just fawned all over him.
You know, this reminds me of what Representative Barbara Lee told us on the show yesterday, that she sees as one of the most damaging impacts of the past 20 years on the United States itself is the cumulative effect of those lies after lies after lies, that it really undermined the American people's confidence in their government. And I would perhaps even go a step further and say it was like a corrosive acid eating away at Americans' confidence in the very idea of what American democracy, not just government, but democracy is supposed to stand for. Jack, what do you think?
Yes, it was just our government consistently feeding us lies and the press until very recently passing them on. We all know the parlous record of the Washington Post and the New York Times in paving the way to war in Iraq with bogus claims fed by hawks in the Bush administration.
Mm. Jack, for the past 20 years, I've both listened to you avidly and had the privilege of working alongside you. And one of the singular things you bring to this program is your deep historical perspective here. And so I must ask, we're talking about the culmination of the longest war in United States history, 20 years in Afghanistan. How would you position the Afghanistan war against other epochal battles that the United States has fought in?
Well, you know, writing in his journals at the time of the Mexican War, Ralph Waldo Emerson noted, quote, "The United States will conquer Mexico, but it will be as the man swallows the arsenic which brings him down. Mexico will poison us." Well, 9/11 poisoned us. It let loose some of the darkest features of American history and some of the darkest characters who walked the stage of that history, culminating, of course, in Donald Trump. And Trump, as somebody pointed out, he really learned the lesson of 9/11, which as someone put it, was the terrorists were whomever you said they were. The poisons released by 9/11 washed him forward.
Mm. One of my great lessons, you know, experiencing half my life, a little less than half my life in the period since 2001, is it was this two-decade-long journey into understanding how political networks become ideologies. And that once they become ideologies or movements, you can't just root them out by force. You can't even root them out with money. It takes something else entirely. And I don't think I fully know yet what it takes to root them out. Now, of course, that lesson came to us in terms of what happened in Afghanistan, coming full circle with the Taliban back now. But I would hope that we apply that lesson here in the United States as well. You know, what does it take when networks become ideologies, become movements? What does it take to quell those movements and preserve the core nation that those movements might seek to undermine?
It's an impossible task, really, isn't it? It's a fire in the mind. And once it starts, you can't, you know, it doesn't show that it's there. You don't know who harbors it. But it's out there. And the social media, of course, makes it ubiquitous and spreads the infection, spreads the fire. But there's a line between the thought and the deed. And if you cross that line, the rule of law has to punish you and punish you severely. And one can only hope that that's going to be the fate of so many of these terrorists from January 6th, and maybe even if there's any justice for Donald Trump himself for inciting them.
And yet, Jack, I don't know, maybe it's just a fault of mine. I insist on ending with a note of hope, okay? And that is, I keep thinking about the first part of our series this week with Shabana Basij-Rasik, the founder of that first and only boarding school for girls in Afghanistan, right? She's just 31 years old. And remember, she ended that hour saying, if there's a burning within her now, it's that she has even more ferocity to fight for the future of her country. And I think many people also in the United States right now feel the same way about this country.
I think you're right. And we have to hope they prevail. And that young woman, her courage, you know, listening to that, even though I deplored the war in Afghanistan, I said, by God, it's justified in opening a life for her, something she couldn't have had. And it's tragic to think it might be snuffed out now. But listening to her, they can't take that away from her. It's there, and it's there in the women in the streets in Afghanistan. And they got that. They got the opportunity to express that through the sacrifice of American soldiers.
Hmm. Well, Jack Beattie, it's been a privilege to work along with you over these past difficult and historic 20 years, and I look forward to many more years. Jack, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Jack Beatty is On Point's news analyst. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.